Welcome, everybody. It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2022, Christian Billinger, an investor at Billinger Verwaltning, a family-held investment company with no external capital. The simplicity of the setup, as well as permanent and patient capital, provides Christian with the proper environment to pursue his strategy of identifying long-term compounders. Christian focuses first on the qualities of robustness and resilience, which limit downside potential before determining the mix of returns on capital and scope for reinvestment opportunity that accounts for the upside. Often these factors overlap with family-controlled management teams that more conservatively finance their operations. Prior to Billinger Verwaltning, Christian worked as a European equity analyst for various investment funds. Before that, he was an associate at PwC. He holds an MS in accounting and finance from the London School of Economics, as well as Karlstad University. He is also a CFA charter holder. Christian splits his time between London and Sweden. Great pleasure to have you with us again this year, Christian. I'll now turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, John, for the introduction. Thank you for inviting me to present at the conference. As you know, I'm a big fan of what you do, and I think you know, it's a very high quality conference. Like all the events you put on, I think it's a great time of year to sort of get back into the habit of looking for new ideas. So very excited to be here. And let's see now if we can move to the next slide. Right, so there's three parts to this. The first two will be pretty brief. So it's a brief background on the company that I run. Secondly, I just want to spend a few minutes following up on the companies and industries that I talked about a year ago. And thirdly, and that will be the bulk of the presentation, I will spend some time talking about LVMH, which is one of our largest holdings and one that we feel very comfortable owning, hopefully for a long period of time to come. So briefly then, a background on Billinger Verwaltning. And I think this is helpful also to put the idea LVMH, to put that idea into context. So basically, it's a private investment company where we invest our own money. So we don't have any external investors in this. And therefore, we can be very long-term and concentrated. So we tend to hold 15 to 20 very high-quality businesses, listed businesses, mainly in Europe and the US. And we buy these companies, or we take these positions with no intention of selling them. Although, of course, sometimes you know, things happen that result in disposals, partly or fully. But certainly, the intention is to buy and hold these businesses and to earn the underlying returns of the business. So I think that's important to keep in mind when you listen to my sort of views on LVMH. And because of the structure and the ownership of this business, it's a family-owned investment business, our priority is capital preservation and the idea of by being good but not great, which is so wonderfully expressed by Tom Gaynor, we hope we can deliver great returns over time. But what I mean by that is we're not looking for the exotic, you know, we're not looking for sort of high risk, high potential return ideas. We're looking normally for something in the range of 8 to 12%, say 10% on average, returns per annum over very long periods of time. And we think if we can deliver that, we'll do very well. And you can find more information on what we do on our website, billingerforvaltning.se. And so just to put LVMH into context, we haven't put new money into an LVMH or almost any other holdings for a long time now. We did invest very heavily in spring 2020, but since then we've been net sellers in aggregate. And I think it's an important caveat. So I think if the conference was called, best ideas for 2022, then LVMH may not be where you'd want to be looking, if that makes sense. But I think for the long term, it's still a wonderful business. It's a core holding of ours, and we feel very comfortable owning it. And this, you know, this is follows the principles of, show me what you own, as opposed to me sort of presenting an idea I like the sound of, but that where we're not invested yet. Right, so that's sort of background on the company, and just to put the idea into context, I also wanted to spend a few minutes briefly following up on what I talked about a year ago, because I feel that's a more, I think that's a more transparent way of doing it. I've listened, like I'm sure many of you have, to endless presentations and pitches by, sell side brokers, and there's no sort of follow up or accountability in there. And so I wanted to tell you a little bit about what has happened to those companies I talked about 12 months ago. So I did a presentation called Three Clusters of High Quality Businesses, and they made up 37% of our NAV at the time. And the clusters were elevators and escalators, where we have Kone and Schindler. We still own those. It was testing, inspection and certification, where we own Intertek and SGS. And it was aircraft engines, where we own MTU. We own all of these companies still. So just to follow up on what has happened in terms of share price performance. So since I presented those ideas a year ago, share price performance has been disappointing. It was, but on average, we haven't lost any money in these positions. Performance has been on average flat since then. So in the case of Kone and Schindler, the main reason they've underperformed is clearly the fact that they're so exposed, especially in the case of Kone, they're so exposed to China construction, and there's obviously been a lot of noise around, some of the large players in that industry and their sort of financial situation and the construction market overall in China. So Kone was down marginally, Schindler up marginally since then. In the case of Intertek and SGS, I think the concerns are slightly more structural. So in the case of Kone and Schindler, I think you could argue these are still wonderful businesses. But of course, China is a very significant market, and there are some concerns there for now. I think in the long run, they'll do wonderfully well. In the case of Intertek and SGS, there are some internal structural concerns around investment levels, and whether managements of these companies are overly focused on short-term financial delivery at the expense of long-term performance. And we share those concerns. Those holdings are, in the case of Intertek, down a little bit, in the case of SGS up a little bit. But clearly, when you look at, even if they've done okay on an absolute basis, clearly in the sort of market we've been in the last 12, 18 months, they're running way behind what the market has done. And in the third case of MTU, clearly that's been very driven by sentiment around travel restrictions, and so that's been sort of stop start. Shares are down about 12% since I presented the idea, but similarly to Kone and Schindler, we think it's a wonderful business, and as I say on this slide, we remain positive on Kone and Schindler and MTU. We do have those structural concerns on SGS and Intertek, which means we've approximately halved our exposure to both of those. There's a lot to like about, industry dynamics, demand dynamics, and the sort of business model. But we have concerns around governance and management. So that's sort of where we stand on those. I guess my sort of view is there's downside protection in these ideas, which is key to the way we invest. If you look at the way they generate revenues, the cost structure, the balance sheet, etc. Because
I think unfortunately, John, these are probably five of the worst. They may very well be the five worst performing sort of holdings we had during 2021. But despite that, we've not, on average, we haven't lost any of our capital. You know, we were sort of flat. And I think, you know, I take some encouragement from that because clearly there's downside protection here. You know, we haven't, it hasn't quite worked out the way we wanted it to, but the capital base is still intact. And as you can see on three of those five, we're still very positive long-term. So that's just to sort of follow up on what I talked about a year ago. And so let's get to the sort of core of this presentation now, which is LVMH. And as I said, a core holding of ours, a very large position for us in the 10% range or so. And we've held it for a number of years and we hope to continue to hold it for a number of years. So I've listed a handful of reasons why we like and love LVMH so much. It's clearly not an undiscovered idea, but it's also in a way typical of what we're looking for. We're not looking for sort of necessarily under-researched or unusual ideas. We're looking for reliable compounders. And I find that they tend to be underappreciated by the market often, even if they're large and sort of well-researched, etc. Now, LVMH is clearly a lot bigger in terms of market cap than most of our holdings. And we're very agnostic in terms of size. You know, we've had holdings that have been as small as, say, 20 to 50 million US dollars in the portfolio. But we also have mega caps like LVMH and Berkshire. And so LVMH just happens to be a very good or great company that is also now, as a result of that, a large market cap. So the reasons we like this, in brief, first of all, they have great brands. And these brands have been great for a long time. You can see this in their financials. If you look at the gross margins in the mid 60s, operating margins in the low 20s, clearly very profitable. And as we shall see, a high return on capital business. So that's number one. Secondly, they're able to grow these brands and they should be able to continue to grow them for a long time. They've averaged about 10% growth in the last decade between the financial crisis and the pandemic. I don't know whether the number should be 10 or 8 or 6% in the decade to come, but I think they should be able to grow these brands at a pretty healthy rate, as we'll get back to. Thirdly, I think for a generalist investor, LVMH is a great way to get broad exposure to luxury, global luxury goods, because they're very diversified across different categories, price points, geographies, and distribution channels. There's other great companies in this, in the luxury space, like Hermès or others, but they tend to be more focused in terms of categories and geographies, etc. And so I think if you're an sort of industry expert, that may make a lot of sense. I think for us, this is a great way to get that luxury exposure through one holding. Fourth is the fact that execution is very strong here. I mean, they really, you know, number one, the first point here is they have a collection of great brands, but of course you need strong execution to sort of monetize those brands. And we'll look at a number of examples of what they do to sort of enable that. And lastly, but not least important, there's the family ownership, which enables this long-term vision, which I think is hugely important, not least in this space. Right, so on the first point, in terms of brands, LVMH has about 75 brands across a number of categories. The most important one, which clearly is the fashion and leather goods division. And the numbers you see here are for pre-pandemic, so they're 2019, because you know, so much sort of there was so much movement between divisions in during the pandemic in 20 and 21 that I think these are quite meaningful to look at. the most important brand by far is Louis Vuitton, which is almost half of their operating earnings. So clearly hugely important. Although, as we shall see, LVMH is still less reliant on LV than some of the other luxury groups are. If, for instance, if you look at Kering and Gucci, or if you look at Richemont and Cartier. And Dior is the other very significant mega brand in this division. Both of these have performed wonderfully in recent years. They then have, and these are in sort of descending rank here or order of importance. So they then have the wines and spirits business. Most of this is in a joint venture with Diageo, which is also a holding of ours. So if you exclude the still wines at the bottom, most of the so the champagnes and the Hennessy business is in that joint venture. So in terms of champagnes, they have some of the most iconic brands you can imagine in terms of you know, Moët, Dom Pérignon, Krug, etc. They of course have the leading cognac brand globally, which is international sort of premium cognac brand, Hennessy. And that they then have a number of very prestigious wine properties, or including Château d'Yquem in Sauternes. They have Cheval Blanc. They also have some holdings in the US, including Colgan, some extraordinary wines. Thirdly, they have selective retailing, and this is a bit of an eclectic collection of retailing and other assets. We also include other, such as Belmond, which the hotels group they acquired a few years ago, with a collection of wonderful properties across the globe. They also have some media exposure here, but of course, from a group point of view, it's not very significant. Fourth, they have perfumes and cosmetics with brands like Christian Dior and Acqua di Parma. And then finally, they also have a watches and jewelry business, which has been relatively, as I said, these numbers relate to pre-pandemic. So that was about 6% of operating earnings, with brands like Chaumet and a number of watches brands. But of course, what has happened since then is that they've completed the acquisition of Tiffany. So this will now become a more important part of their business. Right, so they have, I guess, what we've talked about so far is the great collection of brands they have. And now, secondly, you know, what enables them to grow these wonderful brands going forward? So firstly, China's, you know, like for almost any consumer goods segment or category, China has been hugely important. Chinese consumers, so this refers to the nationality of the consumer and not necessarily where the purchase takes place. Pre-pandemic, Chinese consumers accounted for, I think, a little more than one third of global luxury spend. And of course, much of that took place in Europe. Since then, a significant portion of that has been repatriated back to China. For instance, through a number of these duty-free zones that have been established there. But so wealth creation in China has been hugely significant for companies like LVMH. And I think it'll continue to be very important for them. Longer term, of course, you know, we can only hope that some other emerging markets also make a more meaningful contribution here. But I think for now, China is the one to keep an eye on. Like for so many other consumer goods segments, premiumization, price, and mix has been and should continue to be very important, i.e. selling more expensive and more refined expressions of a certain product, or raising prices on existing products. And the sort of balance between price, mix, and volumes tends to vary over time for a group like LVMH. But there's some element of each of those factors in there. Cross-selling, let's call it cross-selling, I think it's really about the very strong hold they have on the luxury consumer, I think is hugely valuable to a group like LVMH. I'll give you an example. I was in Paris in early December, and I went to visit the beautifully restored Samaritan department store. And so here's an example of how LVMH can sort of the very broad exposure they have to the luxury consumer. So adjacent to the department store is a Chevaldon Hotel, which is owned by the LVMH group. And if you're staying in the hotel, you'll be treated to Dior beauty products in your bathroom. If you're dining in the restaurant, you may very well order a bottle of one of their champagnes, Dom Perignon, Krug, Runart. And you may then go next door to the Samaritan department store and shop for LV or Dior leather goods or Tiffany jewelry. So there's so many touch points here. There are so many ways they can interact with that, global luxury consumer. And I think that's a huge strength, and advantage for a group like LVMH. Other growth drivers would include continued consolidation of global luxury. So what we've seen, and especially during the pandemic, we've seen that mega brands like LV and Dior have been taking share from other brands. And there are a number of possible reasons for this, but that's very clear. And on top of that, LVMH has also been a very active consolidator in this industry. And they've been, ever since Bernard Arnault established the group, they've been sort of adding wonderful brands to their collection, and they've been building out this portfolio. So I think both organically and in terms of transactions, we would expect that to continue. E-commerce and travel retail also create opportunities to sell to new customer segments. So you're seeing this in China, for instance, where in many so-called tier two and tier three cities, where there may not have been as much of a retail footprint previously, there's now a better opportunity of reaching some of those consumers. And LVMH, for now at least, say that they're relatively agnostic as to where the consumer buys their products, both in terms of channels and geographies. Of course, there are some differences in terms of profitability, et cetera, but I think the mindset is very much, we'll sell the product where the consumer wants to buy the product. And they've, as the pandemic shows, or as the experience during the pandemic shows, they've been very successful in doing that, more than most. And I think finally, there's also a very significant opportunity in hard luxury. For instance, the fact that brand penetration is very low in hard luxury. So if you look at LVMH historically, they've been very much a soft luxury player, i.e. leather goods and fashion and et cetera. Whereas if you look at a group like Richemont, they're much more exposed to hard luxury. Now, with the acquisition of Tiffany, LVMH is clearly sort of stepping up its presence in hard luxury. And there's a very interesting, not least in jewelry, there's a very interesting growth opportunity there over time. And I'm very, I'm excited to see how that plays out over the next 5 or 10 years. So there's a number of structural growth drivers that have been important, and we think they'll continue to be very important. So thirdly, and especially given what I've said about downside protection and the fact that we're very focused on capital preservation first and foremost, we like LVMH because while they're dependent on Louis Vuitton, which as I said represented almost half of group earnings pre-pandemic, they are still much more diversified than, for instance, a Kering, and with their dependence on Gucci, or a Richemont with their dependence on Cartier. So there's great sort of diversification in terms of brands. They're also diversified across categories. So clearly fashion and leather goods is the key driver, but as we've seen, they also have a very meaningful presence across these other categories, all the way from wines and spirits, watches and jewelry, perfumes and cosmetics, and also in retail, on the retailing side. So we like that. And finally, they're diversified in terms of geographies. So their dependence on China and the Chinese consumer, for instance, is slightly less than that of many other luxury groups. And of course, in terms of distribution channels, you know, they, as I said, I think their mindset is we'll sell, and this isn't unique to LVMH, but I think they've done a really good job in terms of growing their travel retail and e-commerce business and investing in Hainan and other duty-free zones in China. They really want to be where the consumer is. And I think you can see that in the numbers they've sort of printed during the pandemic, which have been very impressive. Okay, so fourth, execution. I guess given everything I've said about the quality of the brands and the growth runway, etc., how well does LVMH capitalize on those attributes? And I'd argue they execute incredibly well. So if we look at brand equity, for instance, so it's one thing to acquire and own all these great, wonderful brands. But of course, you have to nurture these brands and invest in them to make sure they remain relevant. And I think LVMH is one of the very best at doing this. You know, and this goes all the way to the top, of course, of LVMH in terms of Bernard Arnault and his, you know, his sort of endless obsession with keeping these products desirable. LVMH is very, very good at price discipline, and which is helped by the fact that they control their distribution network. You know, they sort of, just like a company like Hermès, they will sort of restrict volumes if necessary to keep that or maintain that the price discipline. They're very focused on the customer experience in store. There's all these things they do which require investment and long-term vision to protect and develop and improve the brand equity. And I think they're doing a great job at that. Because of course, which is what is slightly unique in luxury goods as opposed to many other consumer goods segments, is that the offering usually or often drives demand as opposed to the other way around. And so it's therefore it's key to nurture that offering and to maintain and improve the brand equity. So another thing we really like about the way the business is managed is the fact that the Arnault family is so, and I think increasingly focused on downside protection first and foremost. And these are a couple of quotes here by Bernard Arnault, where he says that he wants to manage the business as if it could go under in the next 12 months. And he also says, I try to be optimistic long-term, but pessimistic short-term. And this relates to a number of things like keeping a very strong balance sheet or making sure you invest sufficiently or being diversified across categories or price points or geographies. But he also wants to be, so that's the sort of pessimistic short-term bit, right? You want to make sure that you're there tomorrow. The optimistic long-term bit, I think, is about actually being exposed and, you know, allowing yourself to be exposed to these long-term growth trends and being aggressive when the opportunity presents itself, you know, whether it's an acquisition like Tiffany or whether it's counter-cyclical investment, which I think they're very good at, as in, you know, if you look at how they behaved, say, in spring, summer 2020, they took a much more aggressive stance than most or many luxury goods groups, I think, in terms of, you know, brand investment and fashion shows and all these things. So I like that fact. And in terms of capital allocation, roughly speaking, between the financial crisis and between the financial crisis and the start of the pandemic, we would estimate that Mr. Arnault probably deployed about 30 billion euros of incremental capital, plus minus. And the return on that incremental capital was well in excess of 20%. And that includes both acquisitions he did, so the likes of Belmond or Bulgari. It also includes working capital, of course, manufacturing facilities, including vineyards, etc. So he's clearly shown himself to be able to deploy significant amounts of incremental capital at very healthy rates of return. Now, it's not just down to Mr. Arnault, but I think for now the business is very closely sort of associated with him and his vision. And we'll get to the idea of succession in a bit, but we're hugely encouraged by this, and we think there's significant opportunity to continue to deploy meaningful amounts of capital at very attractive rates of return. And then finally, in terms of why we like LVMH, we like the long-term vision. So clearly, this is enabled by the fact that the Arnault family owns so much of the capital and even more of the vaults of the business. So I've listed a few examples of what we think reflects this long-term vision. So vertical integration, for instance, if you look at LV and Dior, so the very large brands in the group, they're highly, highly integrated, both upstream, as in terms of product development and manufacturing, but also in terms of downstream. So when you look at the way they retail their products, and of course that brings fixed costs and a number of sort of things that may not be in the interests of a short-term operator. But in terms of the control it provides to the LVMH group, the control when it comes to understanding the consumer, securing supplies of products, etc., I think it's hugely valuable. Another example of this long-term vision is the fact that they maintain this prudent financial profile, so a very strong balance sheet, because they want to make sure to be there, not just tomorrow, but they're looking sort of generations ahead. And I think that's very encouraging. They have you may call, as Tom Russo probably would, the capacity to suffer. So I've just given one example here, but the restoration of that department store, the Samaritan in Paris, that I mentioned previously, I think took about 16 years, and they spent almost $1 billion doing it. And there are few, you could probably imagine very few, not just because of the size of the investment, but also because of the time frame. I can imagine very few groups, certainly listed groups, that would be willing and able to do that. And I think that just shows you the sort of long-term mindset they apply. And then finally, Bernard Arnault, I think, is in fact very much like Buffett, both in terms of the origins of LVMH. Of course, he took money out of a family business. I think they were in construction when he came in, and he started deploying that money into luxury goods, I think initially through a stake he bought in Dior, which was very sort of mismanaged at the time. And then he's gradually clearly added to that and built this wonderful portfolio. But also in terms of his financial prudence and focus on staying power, or the fortress balance sheet that Buffett often talks about, the fact that both of them like to invest against the cycle, etc. So I think in much of what Arnault says and does, you can sort of see Buffett, and who wouldn't want to be invested alongside someone like that. So that's the business. That's why we love LVMH as a business. So what does this mean for the earnings algorithm? I don't love the word algorithm, because it suggests some sort of perhaps linearity, and one of the things we like about LVMH is the fact that they're not looking for linearity in terms of earnings progression. But I think it's still meaningful to form some expectation of underlying earnings growth over time in order to form a return expectation. And at a very high level, if we start with organic revenue growth, as I mentioned, it's been about 10% on average between the financial crisis and the pandemic. It ranged from a low of 5% to a high of 14%. Of course, 2020 was a different story, which we'll get to. But so that's the sort of starting point, the 10-ish percent. Operating margins have been relatively flat over that time, partly because of the mix of business. I think it's also partly because they invest for the long term. And if anything, I'm quite encouraged by that, by the fact that there's not this sort of mindset to capitalize short term and boost earnings. And, you know, I like the way they think. And I think it's a very sustainable way to sort of grow revenues and earnings over time. Underlying EPS is also, or I should say EPS, has also grown at around 10% CAGR over that time period. So now, of course, that's the historical numbers. And you could argue, should we expect higher or lower growth going forward? I think our view is, even if they were to grow at slightly lower rates, which is clearly a possibility, there's a very good chance that this will deliver returns in the range that we are looking for. So say the sort of 10-ish percent. It's currently trading at 26. I think it's slightly lower than that number on the slide here now. It's trading at around 26 times, I think, earnings for next year. We think with that sort of free cash flow yield and the earnings growth that we can reasonably expect from this business, we think there's a very good chance LVMH will meet or exceed that 10% hurdle over time for a very long-term investor. And we think they can do so at relatively sort of moderate risk of, you know, of course, there's always risks and we'll get to them. But I think it's an attractive for an investor like us, and I suspect many quality-oriented long-term investors, we think it's a very attractive proposition. So what are the risks and question marks, finally? China is clearly the one to watch here because it's so important in terms of revenue generation and growth. And there's a few things you can worry about. Of course, you can worry about the overall Chinese economy and consumer spending. And you know, some sort of inevitable either slowdown or more rapid deterioration. So that's one thing to clearly be aware of and keep an eye on. Sentiment especially towards Western brands and consumer preferences is another one, which is of course something that needs to be very carefully managed in the Chinese market and to Chinese consumers. And then thirdly, policy, as in government measures, whether it's on taxes or, of course, you know, in the last 6 months, much of the attention when it comes to the luxury names has been around the idea of common prosperity, etc. And so these are, you know, while I don't think, and certainly people who know the industry well and the companies themselves think, if anything, that this could be supportive over the medium to long term, it's clearly something to watch. As I said, so why is China so important? As I said previously, pre-pandemic, Chinese consumers accounted for more than a third of global luxury spend. And that compares to about 20% for Europeans and 20% for Americans. And pre-pandemic, more than two-thirds of that happened outside of China, partly because of price arbitrage, i.e. the fact that these goods would tend to be more expensive in China. And much of that has now been repatriated to China. I mean, partly because Chinese consumers haven't been able to travel because of the pandemic, but also because the Chinese government's deliberately trying to capture much more of the sort of revenues associated with this luxury spending. So more generally, lower growth or recession, not just in China, but more generally, is of course a risk for a business like this because there's significant operating leverage. They have a meaningful, so for instance, they have a very meaningful store network. and there is a significant sort of fixed cost base. So if we look at 2020, for instance, you know, turnover was down 16% organically and EBIT was down 28%. So of course, these are cyclical businesses with fixed, with meaningful operating leverage. So if the economy turns, then these companies would tend not to do so well in terms of top line, certainly compared to some other consumer goods, more defensive consumer goods segments. And then, of course, operating earnings will take a hit, and you'll typically sort of see, you know, multiple compression. And so in that sort of environment, there's a relatively high sensitivity. Higher interest rates is, of course, a risk in terms of asset price deflation, which tends to sort of underline much of luxury spending. In the short to medium term, possibly the pandemic, although I think LVMH and other luxury groups have shown that they're very able to sort of deal with that. Succession is one to be mindful of, because of course LVMH is so closely sort of associated with Mr. Arnault. Now, I think he has four of his five children, I think, are sort of active in the group, and I think there's a very and at very senior sort of level. So I think there's that long-term vision is clearly sort of is visible there as well. But it's of course something to reflect on. And then complacency, you know, given their success, and I think is you know, that's always a challenge to sort of nurture that culture always. And I think they acknowledge, of course, this themselves. And then finally, base effects, as in the size of this business means that it will be much harder to grow it at meaningful rates from here on than if you go back 10 or 20 or 30 years. I've listed a couple of sort of risks in terms of e-commerce. How could that lead to a proliferation of challenger brands? ESG concerns, I think that's probably more on the sort of not so much, well, partly operationally, but I think that's also to do with how the investment community views businesses like LVMH and how they're therefore valued. And that's the last sort of point here, which is positioning and sentiment. You know, it's no secret that this is a great business and it's clearly very loved by investors. And if you look at share price performance, a number of these luxury groups have done very well over the last decade. I mentioned Hermès and Kering. You know, of course, partly that's because they've grown their earnings significantly. But also they've seen a significant re-rating. And that's not just on an absolute basis, because of course, you know, a lot of companies have seen that, but also on a relative basis, i.e. these sort of quality luxury groups are valued at a much more significant premium now than they were 5 or 10 years ago. It trades at a and within that, I should say, LVMH trades at a premium to some or many of the luxury names, but of course a big discount to Hermès, which is a bit of an outlier here. So these are some of the risks or question marks, but we feel that that they are on the whole manageable, and that you know, we think, as I said at the beginning, I think this is really a core holding for us. This is the sort of business where we expect to be able to continue generating returns in the sort of 8 to 12% range or something over time at relatively modest risk. So with that, John, I will hand it back to you.
Thank you so much, Christian, for the very interesting presentation. Just a reminder to everyone listening, if you do have a question, click the Q&A icon in Zoom and write us your question. Speaking of Hermès, there is actually a question related to that. The questioner says, would like your view on criticism of LVMH by some that it is not a great builder of brands compared to its peers like Hermès, and is focused on acquiring brands. The same also got reflected when Hermès rebuffed their intention to acquire it in the past.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. And I guess a couple of points. One of them is that, of course, if we look at Hermès, which I'm a huge admirer of, you know, I think it's a fabulous business. But of course, they're much more focused, and almost inevitably, in the case of LVMH, you know, in order to build this very broad portfolio and to sustain the sort of growth rates, certainly in terms of acquired growth that we've seen from them over a very long period of time, almost inevitably, you will have to go out and buy a number of those brands. And clearly, they have a slightly different philosophy when it comes to the sort of breadth of the portfolio. I don't think I'm qualified to say whether, you know, which of LVMH's brands have been sort of, if they've been as good as Hermès at sort of developing the brand equity, because I think the example of Hermès is quite unusual because they're so clearly very good at it. But I think in the case of Dior, for instance, of course, that business was acquired at a point where it was in very, very significant difficulties. And clearly today it's doing incredibly well. And over a number of decades now, you know, Arnaud has developed that business into what it is today. So I think there are examples like that. I think if you go back 5 or 7 years, clearly the LV brand wasn't doing nearly as well as it is today. And there was a sort of repositioning of the brand in terms of price points and the product offering, et cetera. And clearly it's shown huge success since then. So I think, so yes, I mean, I sympathize with, I agree with the sentiment of that question, that clearly LVMH is, compared to an Hermès, they're more focused on acquiring brands. But I think there are also examples, not least when it comes to some of the very largest brands in the group, where they've done very good work internally, and where they've managed to sort of either turn around or improve these brands hugely. So I think there's a bit of both with LVMH.
Christian, when I think of high-end luxury brands, I feel like there's really two countries that dominate this, France and Italy.
Yeah.
And it seems like LVMH's brands really are French brands. Is that correct?
Well, clearly, if you look at the... Yeah, good point. I think if you look at the main ones, like Louis Vuitton, and you look at Dior, and you look at, you know, the champagne brands and Hennessy, and clearly those sort of fashion and leather goods and wines and spirits, I guess that's very much the case. Clearly in watches and jewelry, that's less the case, especially now with the acquisition of Tiffany, which I think it will be interesting to watch what they can do with what is a much more quintessential American brand, right? Which I think, you know, as European investors, we're much less familiar with. And of course, in the retailing, selective retailing, there's more of a sort of, there are businesses with a non-European heritage. But yes, I think on the whole, the portfolio has a very, unsurprisingly, I'd say, and I think it's a great benefit, it's clearly a very sort of French European heritage. And therein lies, I think, a sort of huge part of the value of this.
Absolutely.
But I should also say, John, it is, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's important for them. I mean, it comes back to the idea of complacency, I guess. It's important to reinvent yourselves and to sort of continuously assess new opportunities. And clearly in the case of Tiffany, there's other examples in the last 5 or 10 years of acquisitions they've made.
successfully. But Tiffany's a good example. I mean, clearly they're looking at, you know, they are looking outside Europe. You know, let's see what happens. I think there's a, especially given Tiffany's, position in hard luxury and jewelry, especially, I think that'll be very interesting to watch.
And I guess my follow-up thoughts would be, in whether in Italy, it seems like there's not as big of a consolidated portfolio.
Yeah,
they're more kind of individual brands that are companies like Gucci or Prada or others.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether there's anything keeping LVMH from actually, you know, starting to expand the portfolio and add some Italian brands over time, because clearly, you know, that could expand their market share if they do it well.
Yeah, good question. I mean, Gucci, of course, is part of the Kering group. I mean, apart from that, I don't know specifically what their views are on some of these Italian brands, but I mean, clearly they're very pragmatic, and I'm sure there's opportunities there. It seems like often, similarly to the spirits world, often some of these great luxury brands with long heritage are often family controlled. And so the very best and most attractive brands are often not for sale. I think that's a real challenge, right? And so if, you know, in the case of Tiffany, that was obviously a publicly listed company where I think LVMH felt they could do a better job of realizing the value of those brands. I think that may be slightly more difficult with some of these great family-owned you know, well-performing luxury brands, but I can't think of anyone in the industry or outside the industry that would have a better network and a better sort of idea of what's going on and what's for sale. And clearly, they're tough negotiators, as we've seen in a number of transactions. So, I'm confident that they are scanning that market as well if any opportunities present themselves. But as I said, I think that's the challenge in this industry. There are some great assets, but they're not necessarily there to buy.
And in terms of capital allocation, I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the mix you see going forward, and to what extent has return of capital figured in their mix in the past?
And so just to clarify, so the second part of your question, do you mean how they think about return on capital?
Yeah, and also how they allocate capital, whether buybacks and dividends figure into that, and how they think about that.
Yeah, no, good question. So clearly, and I think as the first questioner, implied here, clearly they've been very focused on external or acquired. Well, it's a combination of organic and acquired growth, but clearly this is a company that has grown significantly from acquiring other businesses historically. And I think if you look at how that mix might look going forward, they can redeploy some capital internally, i.e. by expanding the store network or But of course, I think that's becoming harder and harder, and also, especially as we see that distribution model shifting somewhat. This is not an industry where we should expect all or nearly all of their business to go online. But of course, that's becoming a more meaningful part of the, you know, of revenues even in luxury goods. And so I think that, you know, the sort of store build out phase, I think, will probably be much less important going forward. Acquisitions, I think, will remain hugely important. We're now beginning to see some of these larger deals, of course, LVMH acquiring Tiffany, but also if you go back a few years and you look at Essilor and Luxottica in a slightly different category combining. And of course, there's other potential sort of tie-ups in this industry. And so I think that will be the sort of key thing. I mean, their mindset clearly isn't, certainly not for now at least, to return most of their cash flows to shareholders, although they do return some. But clearly, this is still very much a company in sort of growth mode, and I would expect that to continue for the foreseeable future. And you know, I guess for a business like this, where they've so clearly demonstrated that they're able to generate very attractive returns on capital, we're very happy for them to do that. And in fact, that's our clear and strong preference.
You mentioned that a few of the family members are involved in the business.
Yeah.
How much do we know about these family members? Is there an obvious first choice? And, you know, do we know whether that second generation can be as obsessed as Bernard Arnault has been?
Great question. So some of... you know, they have been involved anywhere from sort of in anything from managing certain brands in the portfolio to being involved at the sort of board level. So there seems to be sort of pretty broad involvement there. I think it's, of course, as always, it's very difficult to assess how fanatical they are about the business. And of course, that's always a concern. I mean, how likely are you to get someone to follow in the footsteps of a Mr. Arnault and to be as sort of as obsessed and as fanatical about it? I mean, personally, I would say that is perhaps not entirely likely. But I think there's also clearly a sort of a long-term vision here. And I think perhaps, although we'd like to see someone who is obsessed and fanatical about the business, I think in a way, clearly it is also a business in a very different stage of its life cycle now compared to 20 or 30 years ago. And so perhaps it requires a slightly different type of leadership, right? You know, clearly the sort of focus on downside protection has increased. It's a more diversified business. I think maybe you require someone with, or perhaps you do not require a deal maker of the type that Mr. Arnault was 20 or 30 years ago to sort of generate healthy returns for us shareholders going forward. But of course, we prefer to see someone who's obsessed about developing this business further. And I think, remains to be seen, I think, John. I mean, we'll hopefully that is still a number of years off. And I think increasingly we'll sort of hear and see more of the next generation, and we'll be able to sort of form an expectation there. I don't know if that really answers your question very well, but I think it's always, generally speaking, it's always, I think you're unlikely to get the same sort of type of fanaticism from the second generation or third generation. But I guess, there may be other benefits to that, as in they may be more in the sort of capital preservation and sort of moderate growth mindset, which could work out relatively well for us as investors.
If we may, before we wrap it up, I see a question in the queue on a company you discussed last year, MTU Aero Engines.
Yeah.
The questioner would simply like your views on it and asking, especially with an eye to operating leverage in the business.
Yeah, good question. The reason we like MTU is partly because, so very briefly, partly we like we like the position they have in the value chain. So, well, first of all, it's a market that, of course, has enjoyed sort of structural growth for a very long time, until the, with a few exceptions, notably the pandemic. But we still think there will be a sort of reversion to a healthy, whether it's a 4 or 5 or 6% sort of growth rate for that market overall. We think the engine manufacturers and especially the sort of component suppliers are in a very attractive position. You know, barrier, there, it's a very well consolidated industry. Barriers to entry are very high. They're supplying a critical product. So there's sort of, you know, and capital requirements are low. So what you tend to see is very high returns on capital, and specifically in terms of the operating leverage. If you look at a business like MTU, even in a year like 2020, they are of course meaningfully profitable because you know, their capital intensity is relatively low. It's very much an assembly business, right, where they certainly manufacture some components, but they source most of them externally, and so you have this cost base flexibility, so they're able to weather these downturns really well. And of course, there are two parts to their business. There's the new equipment business, the OEM business, and there's also an MRO aftermarket business. And we think they're both attractive businesses. And we think, so I guess, you know, you have an attractive market, we think, structurally, in terms of growth. We think the market structure and their position in the value chain is attractive. And thirdly, we think execution is strong, both in terms of the sort of culture and, you know, if you look at the levels of customers, the sort of service levels they provide to customers and the cost at which they do that, they really are leading in what they do. And we think that will serve them very well. And, you know, and I mean, of course, over 12 or 24 months, there's still a lot of uncertainty. But I think over time, we think and hope that it'll turn out to be a very attractive investment.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we will leave it there. I want to just thank everyone for listening. And Christian, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again this year and to share both your approach to investing as well as your in-depth views on LVMH.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks for inviting me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and look forward to participating in the rest of the conference. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Goodbye. All right. For now.
Take care. Bye-bye.